From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Unseen Danger. The worst hauntings are often those in which nothing is visualized and only sensed, where atmospheres harbor baleful forces and influences that are of deadly danger to the morality, mentality, and even life of the people who experience them. Such forces and influences may be supernatural, or may be due to the strong emotional thoughts of people long dead or still living. It is conceivable that not only the atmosphere, but the walls and furniture of a house may become impregnated for an indefinite period with thoughts and vibrations, and under certain at present unknown conditions, give out a kind of aura which affects people endowed with a peculiarly sensitive and receptive mentality. That is to say, people known to psychical researchers as sensitives. Dr. Louis, an eminent French scientist, and Professor de Osnoval have agreed that such a theory is feasible. Sensitives may be conscious of the evil in a house directly they enter it, or they may live in it for a considerable time without being in the least degree aware of the effect that the evil in the atmosphere, walls, or furniture is having on them. Individuals with a natural proclivity to evil are, of course, the most likely to be affected by a baleful atmosphere. But not infrequently it requires a supreme effort on the part of good people to remain unaffected by such an atmosphere. An instance of this is recorded in the memoirs of Bishop McElwain, a well-known American prelate. It happened in 1869 when he was staying in his father's house in New Jersey. "I made a rule," he writes, "of going each evening at the setting of the sun to my chamber for prayer. One afternoon, as that time approached, I was sitting in the parlor with some company that had just come in. Presently I said to myself, 'The sun is going down, go to your room.' I waited for a very short time, and was conscious that as I waited, the disposition to go decreased. I said to myself, 'I had better go at once,' and rose and went. I had no sooner got out of the parlor into the hall, whence I was to ascend the staircase, ere an indescribable dread came over me, as if some mysterious agency of terror was resisting me. I began the ascent by force. I took hold of the banister and dragged myself up. By the time I had reached the first landing, my room was on the second story. I was so overpowered with dread that I stopped. I dare not go any further. All I knew was that something, some power, some darkness, some unutterable dread was upon me and before me. I pondered for a moment and then went on to the head of the stairs. There I stood again and thought whether I dared go on. My room was at the end of a passage. I pushed forward and got hold of the handle of the door. The dread increased. It seemed a horror of darkness. I stood for a moment deliberating whether I dared open the door. I opened it and rushed to the chair at which I was accustomed to kneel. At the opposite side of the room I knelt, and in a few broken sentences prayed two or three times, looking behind me, as if I expected to see some being there. Directly I got up, all my dread ceased. I was drenched with perspiration. My limbs shook. My nerves were thoroughly shaken. And all the next day, the physical effect was upon me. For 36 hours, my nerves did not recover. I was in good health and spirits prior to this most unpleasant experience. Nothing of the sort had ever happened to me before, and I have never again had a similar experience. I'm sure that my dread and intense horror were due to the presence in the house of a diabolical spirit." It is easy to be skeptical and say the good bishop was at the time in a low state of nerves and the victim of a very morbid and harrowing imagination, but he asserts that he was in good spirits and in a normal state of health. One can only, of course, theorize as to what was the cause of his strange experience. Rejecting an explanation on natural grounds, it might possibly have been due, as he believed, to the presence of a satanic spirit in the house, or the conditions being right, to contact with the harbored thoughts of a former very wicked occupant of the house. Either theory seems to me to be equally applicable. Another authentic case of an invisible, intangible evil. Something in the atmosphere of a room occurred some years ago in Ireland. Student after student who slept in a room in a well-known Roman Catholic college either cut his throat or threw himself out of the window. One student, after staying one night in the room, asked the principal of the college to give him another room and declared that if he remained any longer in the room, he would commit suicide. He said that directly he entered the room, he felt singularly depressed and that every now and then he experienced a strong urge to kill himself. It was only by the exertion of great willpower that he refrained. His emphatic assertion that the atmosphere of the room was impregnated with evil impressed the authorities of the college to such a degree that he was transferred to other quarters at once, and the room in which he had such an unpleasant experience was forthwith kept permanently sealed. It will probably be argued that the desire on the part of the student to destroy himself was due to his having been told about the suicides, but the college authorities seem to have taken particular care that the student should not be told about them, and when he was subsequently interrogated, he asserted that he had never heard of them. Could the highly emotional thoughts of the first suicide in the room have become embedded in the room and produced a kind of aura capable of being transmitted to persons who occupied the room subsequently, even afflicting them with the same mental sufferings and imparting to them the same desire to kill themselves? Such a theory seems to me to be quite feasible. But what caused the first suicide in the room? Was it the mere desire of a former occupant of the room to do away with himself? Was the dead, prompted by an evil spirit, attracted in some curious way to the college, or had he harbored a suicidal tendency before he came to the college? If the other suicides were merely imitative and not due to his transmitted thoughts, one must assume that the self-killers all had a previous proclivity to suicide. Such a thing is hardly probable. A similarly haunted room is mentioned by Dr. Nichols in his book Supramundane Facts and Life of the Reverend J.B. Ferguson. He writes thus: "A lady of my acquaintance became suddenly very unhappy by the simple fact of having gone to live in a house which was really quite pleasant and convenient, and the feeling of moral depression which invaded her attained an excessive degree when she went into the best room of the house. If she persisted in remaining there, she felt an irresistible impulse to throw herself out of the window. On the other hand, as soon as she went out and got into the street, the sentiment of depression, with its somber thoughts and impulses towards suicide, disappeared entirely, to return at once when she went indoors. Under such an obsession, the lady had to remove to another house. I was informed of the fact," Dr. Nichols continues, "and desirous of clearing up the mystery, I started an inquiry concerning the previous inhabitants of the dwelling. It was not long before I found out that it had been occupied by a gentleman whose wife, afflicted with suicidal mania, had thrown herself head first from the window of the best room and was killed on the spot." Dr. Nichols wonders if the emotional thoughts of the lady who committed suicide could have produced an aura sufficiently strong to be transmitted to the lady who left the house owing to the suicidal urge which she experienced when in the best room. A certain spot on the Durham Downs overlooking the Avon Gorge at Clifton, Bristol, has witnessed many suicides. Why this particular spot has been selected for a plunge to death is a mystery. There is nothing remarkable about it, nothing to distinguish it in any way from other spots on the cliffs. It cannot be merely the fascination of height, because other spots in the cliffs are equally elevated, if not higher. The imitation theory might account for some of the deaths, but not all, since some of the self-destroyers have been strangers in the district. They had never been on the Durham Downs prior to putting an end to themselves, and even if they had heard of the suicides, could hardly have located the fatal spot without guidance. But who or what guided them? So far as was known, no living person. What then? It was in the hope of getting a clue to the mystery that I stayed a night at the suicide spot on the Downs, one late summer evening 4 years ago. I had with me a friend from London. The Downs are a favorite evening resort in the summer for Bristolians, and up to nearly midnight there were cars along the road skirting the cliffs and loving couples sitting under the trees. After midnight, the Downs became lonely and deserted, peopled only by the dark shadows of the trees and bushes. The silence was eerie. As the minutes passed, the sense of solitude and desertion intensified. A little after 2 o'clock, my friend declared that he did not feel able to remain there any longer, so we came away. We did not see or hear anything supernatural during our vigil, but we sensed a very subtle evil, magnetically attractive presence in the atmosphere, and could well understand that it might prove extremely harmful and even dangerous to some people. In the case of the haunted cell in the 4th Precinct Police Station of New Orleans, in which an old woman named Anne Murphy had hanged herself, it was definitely proved that several suicides, which occurred in the cell after her death, were instigated by her ghost. What prompted Anne Murphy to hang herself was apparently never ascertained. She was not known to have evinced any suicidal tendency prior to her occupying the cell or while she was in it. Although no tragedy had occurred in the cell before Anne Murphy's advent to it, it was rumored to have been haunted for a long time, so that it was quite possible her suicide was due to the prompting of some very evil supernatural entity. In some houses there is an indefinable mysterious something in the atmosphere that endangers the morals. In others is something that endangers the mentality, and in others is something that endangers the morality and mentality. Maybe it is the lingering harbored thoughts of a former occupant, or very possibly an invisible spirit entity. In a flat in a house in a street adjoining Berkeley Square, tenant after tenant took to drink. In a flat on a neighboring street, tenant after tenant was cited as a co-respondent in a divorce suit. Some people with whom I was acquainted when I lived in London took an unfurnished flat near Shepherd's Market. There was nothing apparently wrong with it. It was on the first floor and self-contained. The rooms which had been redecorated were bright and of a fair size. There were up-to-date conveniences. The other people in the building did not disturb them. They seemed quite harmless and inoffensive. And yet they were far from happy in the flat. They felt a corruptive, seductive influence in the atmosphere, and they constantly had the most unpleasant and revolting dreams. Although they never saw or heard anything of a ghostly nature, they felt sure that the flat was very badly haunted. Their aversion to it increased to such an extent that they left it long before their lease had expired. Their curiosity regarding the history of the house led them to making inquiries in the neighborhood, and they learned that it had formerly been a brothel. Possibly their very unpleasant experience in the flat was due to the lingering affecting thoughts of the keeper and frequenters of the brothel, or possibly the flat was actually haunted by the earthbound spirit of someone closely associated with the brothel. I had a similar experience in an apartment house in Moscow Road, London, and have no doubt that had I made inquiries as to the past history of the house, I should have discovered that it had once been of ill fame. It is always advisable to learn something about the history of a flat or house before occupying it in case of lurking danger in the atmosphere. The Menace of Blackness. In the previous chapter, I've alluded to hauntings by an invisible and tangible force or influence in a house or place that endangers the mentality. I heard of such a haunting when I was a student in Dublin. A relative of mine told me that there was a very badly haunted room in a house near the Waterloo Road. He said that people who occupied the room for any length of time invariably became partially or entirely demented. He slept in the room for 3 successive nights and refused to remain in it any longer. He said that he found the room horribly depressing, and that whenever he slept, he had the most harassing and worrying dreams. The following account of a haunting, which was well calculated to affect the mentality of any nervous person, is related by Mr. J. Westwood in Notes and Queries. In a lonely neighborhood on the verge of Enfield Chase stands an old house much beaten by wind and weather. It was inhabited, when I knew it, by two elderly people, maiden sisters, with whom I had some acquaintance, and who once invited me to dine with them and meet a circle of local guests. I well remember my walk hither. It led me up a steep ascent of Oak Avenue, opening out at the top on what was called the Ridge Road of the Chase. It was the close of a splendid autumn afternoon. The year was dying with more than its usual pomp, wrapping itself in its gorgeous robes like a grand Caesar. On reaching my destination, the sun had already dipped below the horizon, and the eastern front of the house projected an eerie black shadow at its foot. I crossed the threshold with repugnance. Having some changes to make in my attire, a servant led me to an upper room, where she left me. No sooner had she gone than I became conscious of a peculiar sound in the room, a sort of shuddering sound as of suppressed dread. It seemed close to me. I gave little heed to it at first, setting it down for the wind in the chimney or a drop from the half-open door. But moving about the room, I perceived that the sound moved with me. Whichever way I turned, it followed me. I went to the furthest extremity of the room. It was there also. Beginning to feel uneasy, and being unable to account for the singularity, I completed my toilet in haste and descended to the drawing room, hoping that I should leave the uncomfortable sound behind me, but not so. It was on the landing, on the stairs, and went down with me, always the same sound of shuddering horror, faint but audible, and always close at hand. Even at the dinner table, when the conversation flagged, I heard it unmistakably several times, and so near that if there was an entity connected with it, we were two on one chair. It seemed to be noticed by nobody else, but it ended by harassing and distressing me, and I was relieved to think that I had not to sleep in the house that night. At an early hour, several of the guests having far to go, the party broke up, and it was a satisfaction to me to breathe the fresh, wholesome air of the night and feel rid at last of my shuddering incubus. When I met my host again, it was under another and unhaunted roof. On my telling them what had occurred to me, they smiled and said that it was perfectly true, but added that they were so used to the sound that it had ceased to perturb them. Sometimes, they said, it would be quiet for weeks. At other times, it followed them from room to room, from floor to floor, pertinaciously as it had followed me. They could give no explanation of the phenomena. Of what strange horror, not ended with life, but perpetuated in the limbo of invisible things, was that sound the exponent. Although this haunting was less dangerous, perhaps, than the other hauntings that I have mentioned, it was, as I have suggested, quite capable of being harmful to very nervous and impressionable people. To what category of ghostly phenomena this particular phenomenon belongs, no one can rightly say, but it suggests to me the ever-restless, unhappy spirit of some poor wretch, earthbound on account of the kind of life that he had led when in the flesh and blood. The fact that Mr. Westwood's experience was so well corroborated hardly admits an explanation of it on hallucinatory grounds. A very unpleasant supernatural phenomenon, and one which might easily prove detrimental to the soundless mentality, is the black pall or haze. A haunting of this description occurred in the family of my old nurse, always prior to a death. She said that she was lying awake one night, trying in vain to go to sleep, when she was conscious suddenly of something very dreadful in the room. She summoned up courage to light the candle, which was on the chair by the side of the bed. She saw nothing. The door of the room was closed, and the chair, which she had placed against it to prevent it opening, there was no lock, was still there. As she was peering ahead of her, limb-tied and tongue-tied, the empty space between her and the wall facing her suddenly became infused in a sepulchral blackness that was menacing and horrible. My old nurse had the faculty of smelling death, a faculty not uncommon in some parts of England. She smelt its presence now, and she knew that it presaged either her death or the death of someone very dear to her. She was so frightened that she fainted. When she recovered consciousness and ventured to look around her, she no longer smelt death, and the horrible phenomenal blackness had gone. The following day she received a telegram saying that her mother had been seized with a heart attack and had died during the night. Phenomenal blackness is not uncommon as a form of warning. and a book entitled Ghostly Visitors, Mr. Walford, an Oxford undergraduate, says, "There is a ghost at unnamed hospital in London. A cousin of mine is a medical student there, and he told me that he knew when the patient operated upon was going to die, as he always saw a black shade when in the operating ward. When I lived in St. Ives, Cornwall, an old inhabitant of that town told me that he and a friend were on the Castle Andenas hilltop late one summer evening when they both saw a pall-like black haze appear over the broken rocks in front of them. There was something so ominous and sinister about it that they were frightened. It vanished as suddenly and mysteriously as it had come, and they were quite unable to account for it. A day or two later, the friend received tidings of the death of his twin brother. He had died just about the same time the black haze had appeared on the hilltop. It is difficult to find any satisfactory explanation in these cases of pall blackness other than the supernatural. The lonely moors and hills that constitute the hinterland of St. Ives are much haunted, not only by the ghosts of old-world people, but by elementals as grotesque in appearance as are the fantastically fashioned rocks and boulders amid which they prowl and glide at night. The menace of the indefinable. There are recorded cases in which a haunting by an indefinable something in a house or place has been constitutionally dangerous, wrecking the health and even causing death. An instance of a house harboring a supernatural phenomenon of this kind was reported in the press in December 1919. Tenant after tenant died suddenly in a house in a street in Croydon, or quitted it hurriedly, and as a consequence, the house acquired such a sinister reputation that no one cared to inhabit it. For years it stood empty. Children hastened past it after nightfall. Dogs were never seen to enter the garden. Yet no one seemed to know what exactly was wrong with the house, whether it was the drains, although there had never been any complaint about them, or rats, or whether the house was haunted. Its appearance, it was just like any other house in the street. From its exterior there was nothing to suggest that it contained anything supernatural and horrible. Yet no one had lived in it for long. They had either died or fled. A newspaper man who had heard about it determined to spend the night there and probe the mystery of the hidden, nameless danger to the core. There were a few pieces of furniture in the house, and he sat in a very dilapidated armchair in a room on the ground floor. Shortly after midnight, a feeling of sickness came over him, and he was conscious of something, void of any definite shape and indescribably loathsome, entering the room through the closed door. He felt it was getting nearer and nearer to him until it finally enveloped him, when he fainted. On recovering consciousness, he could no longer feel the foul presence in the room. The horror that it had inspired was so great, however, that he lost no time in getting out of the house. He had been in excellent health prior to his vigil in the house, but the shock he experienced that night was so terrible that he became seriously ill and died within a fortnight. I did not see the newspaper accounts of his experiences until a long time after its occurrence, and when I made inquiries about the house, I was informed that it had been demolished. People who are skeptical regarding the existence of supernatural phenomena will no doubt suggest that the unfortunate journalist was paranoid and the victim of a sensorial illusion. They will say that he knew the reputation of the house and that a long solitary vigil in the dark very probably excited his imagination and made him believe that he actually sensed the presence in the room. But could mere imagination or illusion create a shock sufficiently strong to cause the death of a young man asserted to be in excellent health? In an old issue of Notes and Queries, there is a strange story of an encounter with an indefinable, dangerous supernatural phenomenon in Somersetshire. During the year 1840, Mr. T. stayed for several months in Taunton. While he was there, he became very friendly with Mr. S., a bluff, genial fox hunter, who told him a very unusual story of a haunting in Somersetshire. Mr. S. said that when he returned home from the local hunt after dark, he often observed a central window in an old mansion, not far from the roadside, strangely illuminated. All the other windows were dark, but in this particular window a wan, dreary light was visible. As he knew that no one was living In the house, the queerly lighted window puzzled and intrigued him. On one occasion, having a hunting friend with him, he suggested that they should solve the mystery of the luminous chamber without delay. His friend agreed. They proceeded to rouse the old porter in the park lodge. After much grumbling, he gave them a lantern and the keys of the house. The light in the central room of the house looked more wan and weird the nearer they approached. It was unlike anything they had ever seen and seemed to emanate from another world. A creepy feeling came over them when they turned the handle of the ponderous, weather-worn old front door and stepped into the wide, empty, long-deserted hall. Not a sound other than reverberating echoes of their feet greeted them as they crossed the stone-flagged floor to the broad, black oak staircase in the center of it. The higher they ascended, the more intense became the oppressive sense of loneliness and utter desolation. They visited all the rooms, leaving the luminous one until the last. There was nothing particularly noticeable in any of them. They were all gloomy and depressing, but on entering the central room, a marked difference was at once perceptible. The strange light in it enabled the two investigators to distinguish the various articles of furniture, which were scanty and common. What struck them most was the uniform diffusion of the light. It was as strong under the table as it was above the table, so that no single object projected any shadow on the floor, nor did they themselves project any shadows. The reflection of the wan light and their own awe-stricken faces in the great mirror over the mantelshelf startled the investigators. Mr. S. declared that he had not been many seconds in the room before he experienced a horrible sensation, as if all his vitality was being sucked out of him. His friend experiencing a similar sensation, they became very scared and got out of the house as quickly as possible. When they told the old lodge porter their experience, he said that no one had ever been able to remain in the luminous room for very long. He would not admit that it was haunted, but said that it had a queer light of its own. Neither Mr. S. nor his friend ever visited the house again. Skeptical people will probably attribute the sucking sensation which Mr. S. and his friend experienced to sensorial illusion. Sensorial illusions, technically speaking, are not mental delusions. They only become so when they are believed to be realities. So, in this case, if the fox hunting squires were the victims of sensorial illusions, they were mad, since they were convinced that the sensations that they experienced were real. But they were not mad. They were jolly, hearty, healthy sporting hunters. Consequently, the sensations which they experienced simultaneously were not illusions, but were due to some mysterious natural cause, or to the presence in the room of an invisible, intangible, vampiric, supernatural force or entity. The eerie phenomenal light in the room makes the latter explanation, in my opinion, rather the more feasible. Hoodoo. John Aubrey, in his book Miscellaneous, mentions the following houses that were reputed to be very unlucky in his time. The Fleece Tavern in Covent Garden was very unlucky for homicides. A handsome brick house on the south side of Clerkenwell Churchyard had been so unlucky for at least 40 years that nobody would venture to occupy it. No one who lived in an attractive house in Holborn ever prospered. No third generation of a family ever remained in the Charter House on the Mendips in Somerset, or in the Manor of Butley near Glastonbury. At the present time, there is a house not far from Rugby, which has always proved unlucky to every family that lived in it, and in an isolated spot near Caterham, there is an early 18th century house reputed to be so hoodoo that none of the local people care to pass by it alone after nightfall. It came into notice shortly before the Second World War, owing to the deaths of its owner and his wife, who were found dead in a car in the garage. There were no marks of injury on their bodies, and it was thought, but never definitely proved, that they had been poisoned by carbon monoxide. An elderly man who had lived in the neighborhood of Caterham for many years told a representative of the Bristol Press that bad luck, in some form or other, always overtook everyone who occupied the old house. A picturesque old farmhouse in a village near Caithness acquired a sinister reputation in the 20s of the present century owing to three tragedies that occurred in it during 12 years. One owner of the house shot himself. Another owner of the house was murdered. After the third tragedy, the house was said to be haunted by an invisible evil spirit that urged people to commit suicide or murder. No one ventured into the grounds of the house alone when it began to get dusk. Dogs would not go near the place, and horses shied and bolted if made to pass it. A house in a suburb of Birmingham bore a very ominous reputation for many years. No murder or suicide was known to have taken place in it, but it had witnessed a number of other tragedies. The following were a few of them. A lady descending a staircase in the house one day tripped over something that she could not see, fell, and sustained such internal injuries that she eventually died. Within a few months after her death, a servant belonging to the establishment severed an artery while chopping sticks for the kitchen fire and died before a doctor arrived. A year afterwards, a boy threw a stone at the house. It broke a window. A piece of glass struck a little girl in the face. It did not kill her, but she lost the sight of one eye. Not long afterwards, the brother of the little girl fell out of the nursery window and was fatally injured. So evil a reputation did the house acquire in consequence of these calamities that no one would inhabit it, and it was ultimately demolished. Some houses look ominous. An old isolated house that was not very far from Warwick gave one that impression. It was a stately, somber building, half hidden by trees, half classic, with a large ornate Tudor porch that contrasted oddly with the windows, which belonged to different periods, some of them Tudor and others dating from the days of Dutch William. The house had a malign, unhappy air and looked haunted, and so it was, but by no visible ghost. It was just an unlucky house, a house that engendered misfortune on whoever inhabited it. No one knew why. So far as was known, it had witnessed no grave tragedy, nor had any curse ever been pronounced on it. Yet the moment a sensitive crossed the threshold, he experienced a forebodement and sensed a harbored supernatural harassing element in the atmosphere. Some of the occupants of the house became bankrupt. Others had very unhappy marriages. Loved ones died in the house under very distressing circumstances. No one ever lived tranquilly in the house. In the end, it was pulled down mainly because it was so unlucky. There is a corner in a room in a Mayfair men's club that is hoodoo, owing to the fact that members who have sat in it have invariably died soon afterwards. Even on fine, bright, warm summer days, the light in that particular corner is always subdued, and there is a chilly feeling in the air. No satisfactory explanation of the blight which envelops the corner has ever been found. Hoodoo is not confined to buildings. There are hoodoo roads, woods, pools, and outdoor places of all kinds. There is a hoodoo corner of a road not 50 miles from Northampton. It inspires an ominous feeling even in pedestrians who pass it in broad daylight. No tragedy, nothing grim or awful, is known to have ever occurred at or near the corner to account for it being hoodoo. Yet it is thought to be very unlucky. There are hoodoo cars and trains, and in the old days there were hoodoo hansoms and four-wheelers. I remember hearing about a London hansom which no man cared to drive on account of the number of accidents it had experienced, and a four-wheeler that bore similar reputation. The car in which Francis Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated at Sarajevo was regarded by the peasants as bewitched. During the 1914 war, it was kept in a Viennese museum. When police was declared, it was bought by the Yugoslav governor of Bosnia and Herzegovina. He incurred so many accidents when in it that he sold it. The man who bought it was found dead in a ditch one day, with the car unharmed close to him. Mr. Tiber Hirschfield was the next person to own it. He was taking 6 friends to a wedding one day when it collided with another car, which it was trying to pass at a great speed. No one was killed, but everyone was badly bruised and shaken. Mr. Hirschfield tried to sell it, but it had acquired such a hoodoo reputation that no one would buy it, so he destroyed it. In 1928, the GWR train from Newton Abbot to Paddington was regarded as an unlucky train on account of the number of fatalities associated with it. Mr. J. Hubbard of Newton Abbot, who drove it from that place to London, was taken ill when the train was traveling at express speed. He was removed to a waiting room at Exeter Station, where he died 10 minutes later. A few months previously, Fireman Palisland died as a train steamed into Paddington, and in November 1927, Fireman Walters was killed while getting the engine of the train ready for starting. 3 fatalities in 12 months. It was little wonder that the train acquired an ill-omened reputation. It was known as the Ghost Train. Hoodoo ships are far too numerous to include in this chapter. Places that have been cursed are often hoodoo. But why places and things that are not associated with any curse or any known satanical acts, deeds, or transactions should be extremely unlucky is a seemingly insoluble mystery.